Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Bruce Ashford to the podcast. Dr. Ashford serves as provost and professor of theology and culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's also a research fellow at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Dr. Ashford, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a delight to have you in the studio today. You are on campus delivering our Scudder lectures. You've already delivered one. You'll be delivering another one tomorrow. So it's just a delight to have you on campus and in the studio here for a couple days.
A lot of fun to be on campus. This is a happy place.
Yeah, you know, we refer to ourselves, and I think accurately, as the happiest seminary campus in North America. And so that's certainly our aspiration. There's a cheerfulness here, joy here. And, you know, that doesn't just happen. You have to cultivate that. You want to hire the right people who exude that and just frame yourself, present yourself, be the type of school that has much to be happy about. So we're working that way. But look, it's great to have you here. I tell people all the time that Southern Baptists have six seminaries we can be very proud of. Beyond even the SBC, there are many other evangelical, healthy, strong evangelical seminaries that are doing good work. Now, it's a good list, but it's not a terribly long list, meaning there are a lot of bad seminaries out there. But I'm thankful for those Southern Baptist seminaries. I'm thankful for our other capital E evangelical seminaries, confessional evangelical seminaries that are doing good work as well. And so you're Exhibit A of that. You're at Southeastern Seminary. The president, Danny Aiken's a dear friend. Many faculty colleagues there who are friends doing similar and sister work. So thank you for all you guys are doing in Wake Forest.
Yeah, thank you. Same back to you.
Yeah, so before we get into the meat of the conversation today, let's have a little front porch time. Tell us a little bit about yourself, stage of life, family, and what you're doing at Southeastern.
Yeah, so I'm married to Lauren. We've got three children, Riley, 8-year-old daughter, Anna Kate, 7-year-old daughter, and then John Paul Kuyper Ashford. So named after a disciple, a church planting apostle, and Abraham Kuyper.
Very good. And so you guys are at Southeastern, obviously, where you serve. How long have you been there? Tell us kind of what's on your mind. What's going on at Southeastern, what you're teaching these days, writing interests, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I've been at Southeastern either as a student or a professor for a little over 20 years, with the exception of a brief break overseas where I lived in Russia, and serve now as provost and dean of the faculty and teach professor of theology and culture. So at the undergrad level, I teach intellectual history, and at the master's and PhD level, theology and culture, public theology, type courses, and a little bit of missiology. It's an exciting time to be at Southeastern. Got a great president, a lot of energy on campus. Reminds me a lot of Midwestern.
Well, praise the Lord for that, both for the similarities and for what's going on independently there at Southeastern. We're talking today about the pastor and politics. Now, before we get into that topic, a word or two about your background. You have a background in political science and political interest, and so perhaps unpack a touch of your personal narrative.
Yeah, you know, so growing up, I was interested in those sort of things. I enrolled in college as a double major in government and political in journalism with an emphasis on political journalism. Ended up just majoring in journalism, and I was in College Republicans and ran for freshman class president and served in student government and so forth. But within a few years, I felt called out of that and into ministry. So I ended up going to seminary, served as overseas in Russia for a little while, and then have served as a professor. But a few years ago, felt really called to enter back into the public arena, and have since been doing public theology, been writing a little bit for Fox and for Heritage Foundation, Daily Signal, and have been teaching and writing in this area of politics and public life. I think it's a challenging avenue, and one that we ought to sort of embrace.
Well, the past 2 years have presented an abundance of challenges in this regard. One last thing about yourself. You began contributing, as you've already referenced, to the Fox News website, I guess a couple of years ago now. How did that develop? And talk a little bit about your ministry there.
Yeah, so, you know, my book, One Nation Under God, co-authored with Christopher Pappalardo, got some good attention, and my publisher and their publicist ended up connecting us with Fox. And then once I got my foot in the door at Fox, they were very kind to me and said, we'd like you to keep on writing. And so I write for Fox, and I think they've given me a platform where I can speak with a distinctively Christian voice. They're not afraid of me doing that. Some of the other outlets want me to reason without my Christianity, and I can do that. But that's what I like about Fox, is they let me use my full voice.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I we're talking today about the pastor in politics, and hearing your personal story, it reminds me a lot of my own. As we talked about at dinner last night and fellowshiped over my own story, I had a just profound interest in politics as a teenager, one of these kids that watched the news every night, loved to watch it with my dad as he would watch what's going on in the world. And went to college as a political science major. I graduated, a history minor, intending to go to law school. And I just love politics. I worked in my first campaign when I was 16 years old, the 1994 Republican gubernatorial campaign in Alabama. And I just loved it. And so I go to college. I'm saved my freshman year in college. My junior year, I begin to sense and process this call to ministry. And I wound up going to seminary, and the Lord led me in an altogether different direction. So I refer to myself occasionally as a recovering political junkie. And each one of those words are important, a recovering political junkie. And I have to intentionally, over the years, I've had to put some basic guardrails up in my life so I don't spend too much time, you know, watching the news, reading the news, keeping up with politics, handicapping politics, commenting on politics, and I have to put up some healthy parameters there just to make sure I'm not giving too much time or interest or giving more credibility or ascribing more influence to the political realm than really it's due.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think one important thing to remember, I think, in our political interaction is to play the long game and take the broad view. And by take the broad view, I mean not to put all of your eggs in the basket of politics. We also have marriage and family and church, very significant. We've got art and science and education and all of these other spheres of culture. And, you know, if we can, on the whole, as the church, invest our energies in all of those spheres of culture, the combined effect is pretty powerful. And then I think play the long game is the advice when you're doing politics, not to put all of your eggs in the basket of short-term activism. You'll be tempted to sacrifice long-term witness on the altar of that. You're right about the political junkie thing. I mean, in addition to what you said, I think when we're reading, especially just the circumambient imbecility of the discourse today, when you're spending all of your time listening to the talk show hosts and reading this stuff, it'll begin to shape your worldview. And just sort of subtly, the Bible's narrative won't be the master narrative. It'll be MSNBC or Fox or whatever outlet.
Well stated. Bruce, let's stop here just for a word of update from Midwestern Seminary.
Midwestern Seminary's 81-hour Master of Divinity degree prepares you for ministry today and tomorrow. Midwestern Seminary's flagship degree program is our primary track for ministry preparation. Requiring only 81 credit hours, the MDiv program is an efficient option for students, equipping them to serve the church in pastoral ministry. Residential students will be trained in a unique community environment passionately focused on the local church. Online students can earn the full degree without leaving their current ministry context. Come be a part of one of the fastest growing seminaries in North America as we develop a new culture of discipleship devoted to the local church and committed to taking God's unchanging word into a rapidly changing world. Visit mbts.edu/mdiv today.
All right, I'm back with Dr. Bruce Ashford. We're talking about the pastor in politics. So the past 2 years, as I've already referenced, has presented unique challenges as evangelical Christians engaging, understanding, interpreting, living in the political sphere. So I want to do two things. Just to kind of make plain from where you're coming from the conversation, just give a brief word of personal reference as to how you assessed the Trump campaign as far as the moral complexity of it, how you basically have assessed and engaged the Trump presidency heretofore. And then based after you kind of answer that from a personal autobiographical sense, maybe kind of tell us what just happened. By that I mean the past 2 years have been truly remarkable. So on the one hand, talk us through how you engaged it, how you view it, but also more broadly, how you view what has taken place in America and then within evangelicalism, if we can speak that generally, as to how it's engaged or not engaged, this phenomenon known as President Trump.
Yeah, that's a interesting and challenging question. So when I got back into public life, it was just before the Trump phenomenon. I thought there would something big would happen, but little did I know. So, you know, my approach at Fox was I opposed Trump in the primaries repeatedly from the pages of Fox, and for multiple reasons. One was a moral character. I thought that there was a long pattern of immorality and not remorse. I thought that the governing style would be dangerous and unstable, could cause problems. I thought in terms of policy issues that he departed from traditional conservative policy by 50 to 70% every time he opened his mouth. On the positive side, he did promise a Supreme Court justice who would not violate the Constitution and promised that he would be pro-life. So I posed him before the primary, but and even before the election, I thought that it would be better for us to take a short-term loss in the election and not lose our witness, as I saw it, than to, you know, vote for him. So he was elected. I had a number of friends who voted for him, and I can understand there are reasonable reasons to vote for him. Consider how awful of a candidate Hillary was. But, you know, I've switched my approach. He was elected. He's our president. I want to be able to affirm what he says and does that is good, and he's said and done some good things. And I want to be careful to not to become a cheerleader, right, though, which should always be that case with any politician. But I think there's pressure to be fully on board on one side or the other, and I think we need to avoid that, not to be defined by any one politician or even one party. And so, I want to point out what's good when it's good and point out what's negative when it's negative. What just happened in American politics? Well, that's kind of complex and multifaceted, and we both know probably we won't know that for sure for 100 years, but, you know, I think we have a combination of multiple things. I think we've got some economic and cultural frustrations. Economic frustrations, the working class rose up, but I don't think it's just economic. It's cultural. It's that you've got people out there, especially in rural areas. I grew up rural, but also in cities and in towns who say, I don't recognize my country anymore. I don't recognize it for ideological reasons because of progressive ideology. And just culturally, it doesn't have the feel of America anymore. And we've got lots of people coming in across the borders. And in fact, they're working the job that I wish I could work. And I'm out of work right now, sitting on the couch wishing I had a job. So there's these kind of frustrations. But I also think at the same time, there is a cultural and political illiteracy in our country that means that we can be easily swayed. And I'm not referring to Trump right now. I'm referring just in general that we can be swayed by Russian bots. Facebook campaigns and Twitter campaigns, that we don't understand dangers to democracy. So I think we're in the midst of that. Who knows what's going to happen? Trump ran a full-on frontal assault against William Buckley and Ronald Reagan and the sort of conservative agenda. He has put together a coalition that combines some of the interests of a Reagan-Buckley agenda and some of the interests of the religious right with other interests, So different types of nationalism and so forth. And I wonder, Dr. Allen, maybe you can weigh in on this. Do you think this will change the Republican Party for good? Or is this just a 4 to 8 year sort of side road?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to opine. Believe me, I think political parties, if anything, are dynamic as opposed to static. I mean, they exist to get themselves elected and to win office. And so I think political parties, by definition, will do whatever it takes to win elections. And so I think that is a moving target. I think Trump has accelerated that shift. He has brought about that shift. He has, in some ways, revealed that shift. By revealed, I mean the Republican Party's acceptance, toleration of his well-documented, personally acknowledged, repeated sexual forays beyond the confines of his marriage. Just everywhere. And that was pretty digestible, evidently, for the vast majority of the Republican Party. And I'm not in saying that, talking about those who kind of held their nose and Hillary be worse, and so I'm going to reluctantly vote for him.
Right.
That was a large segment of the populace, yes. But there also was a very large section of the populace that it wasn't a reluctant, I'm going to vote for him because Hillary would be this much worse. It was just, we want to vote for him and we're not too worried about the personal failings. So I think let me try to engage at this level, Bruce. I find myself, one of the checks for myself is I don't want to be too moved by what a politician says or does positively or negatively, or for that matter, what a politician tweets. I don't want it to be that my life to be that engaged where I'm tracking this hour by hour, at times minute by minute, based upon what comment is made, what initiatives proposed, what inflammatory thing is said. I don't want to be that close. To me, that is too close to the fire to live a healthy Christian life. Do you agree with that?
I do. You know, so I think we're going to have to relearn how Christians do public engagement. We've had it pretty good in America for a long time. America has lots of flaws, slavery, I mean, lots of flaws. But on the whole, and in many ways, we've had it easy. We're going to have to relearn it. I think we're going to have to recenter God by retraining ourselves to view public policy and political developments in light of the biblical narrative instead of the MSNBC narrative, Fox News narrative, et cetera, I think we're going to have to work hard to figure out with modern political ideologies, conservatism, progressivism, libertarianism, nationalism, socialism, all of the isms, where the idols are lurking beneath, when and where they're lurking beneath. And early Christians had a keen eye to do that, and that's because the politicians were against them universally. But they haven't been against us universally, so we've kind of let it slide. But we're going to have to not let it slide anymore. And then we got to learn how to, and in the same vein, reframe issues in light of our beliefs. We cannot let, like as you were saying, a secular political party or a political party that has many secular roots, we can't let them frame the issues for us. We frame the issues. And I think that gives us a chance to regain the clarity and power of our voice. You know, rightly or wrongly, and mostly wrongly, but, you know, people like us are referred to as the hypocritical and bigoted special interest arm of the Republican Party. Well, now's our chance to show them we're not, that we think for ourselves, that we can combine truth and grace in such a way that we are genuinely different in our public interaction because of the gospel.
Yeah, look, we have to be willing to engage in nuance, even if we do so understanding that the vast majority of humanity isn't particularly interested in nuance. And I'm not talking about moral nuance. I'm talking about how we assess a politician. Meaning, you look at the past year, look, I give President Trump credit for a lot of things. I mean, there are a lot of things that went very well. Progress has been made that a year or so ago we would have only hoped for.
Yep.
What do I mean by that? Judiciary appointments,
yes.
Most especially Justice Gorsuch. Tax reform. Now, I view tax reform through a moral and theological lens as well, and I think this was a healthy move. Regulatory rollback, good for the society, good for the economy. Issues like engaging ISIS more aggressively and rolling them back. Other policy statements. I was in a meeting a couple of months ago with a couple of leaders from the Heritage Foundation, a couple of other conservative kind of legal networks, and these people were not like out ahead of the Trump train when he was a candidate. But they just gave a very sober, thorough assessment, a several-hour assessment of what is taking place at the agency level through appointments, places like HHS and others, and in the Department of Justice. I mean, it was very, very encouraging. So my point in all that is to not give some big, you know, congratulatory statement to the Trump administration, but to say, look, as an American, as a Christian, I'm thankful for the many gains we've enjoyed this past year. I certainly am. At the same time, I have to be able to hold that and be willing to speak honestly about inflammatory statements, about the appearance of racist statements, about other comments that are made, things that are done that are beyond the pale. And so, again, I think we have to be able to live in tension, and we have to be okay with that and speak maturely to that. One other thing I want to say, again, by way of personal assessment is, and I alluded to this for a moment, but I want to flesh it out just a touch. Again, if I were to track the Trump Twitter feed or the whoever Twitter feed, what's going on is being said hour by hour, I wouldn't have a ministry. I wouldn't have a life.
Yeah.
And it's an unfair expectation for evangelical leaders or for just evangelical Christians to kind of give this play-by-play commentary on what the president or what a politician does on a day-to-day basis. I do not feel that moral imperative to do that. I don't. It's not because I'm cowardly. It's not because I'm not willing to speak to things.
Yeah.
I'm only too happy to give my opinion when I'm asked, and I'm asked all the time. But for me to do that, I wouldn't have a wife and kids, and I wouldn't have a seminary, because it's a more than full-time job to kind of micro-comment on what's going on minute by minute.
Yeah, and there's an expectation by some folks in the States that we ought to always be tweeting our commentary, you know, on absolutely everything that happens. And if you're not doing it, then you lack courage. Well, no, I just have a job and a family and small kids. And like you say, I mean, if you get sucked into this, I mean, you lose your chance to, I think, actually constructively help the country. Back to what you were saying a moment ago, I do think we have a chance, like you're saying, to be an honest broker. For those of us who oppose Trump's candidacy, we have to be willing to admit he's done some good stuff. And then for those who supported it, they need to be willing, I think, also to be an honest broker and say, listen, there's some real negatives here. And if we do that, if we can be honest brokers, it's good for the Christian community.
Yeah, and of course, I'm talking here with Bruce Ashford, provost at Southeastern Seminary, about the pastor in politics. I want to float a theory to you here, Bruce, in the context of this conversation. And here's the theory. This is something I seek to practice. I've encouraged others to practice this way. That is how we, meaning folks like ourselves who are in ministry, how we engage issues or people or topics through social media channels when it's something that we want to seek to correct or offer a counter opinion or outright condemn. And here's kind of my theory. I've encouraged folks that, look, you should engage the evangelical world more broadly or your Christian friends more broadly that you're seeking to engage through your social media channels in a similar way that you would engage your church if you're a pastor. So again, I'm not saying that, you know, political commentator X should engage this way. They're not pastors, not evangelicals. But I'm saying for myself as a minister, as a Southern Baptist in a role of leadership, I have sought over the years to speak to things through social media channels in a similar way that I would to people in my church when I was pastoring as I'm asked. By that, I mean we need to be clear. We need to be clarifying. We need to be gracious. We need to be courageous. There are times we need to rebuke, but we ought not be shrill or needlessly sarcastic are fundamentally uncharitable. We wouldn't speak to people, believers in our church that way, so why would we speak to believers in other churches that way?
Yeah, that's right. I think we can learn a lot from Christian missionaries when we minister here in the States. You know, when a missionary goes into another culture and wants to persuade, the missionary doesn't mock, demean, degrade. What the missionary does is enters in and tries to really listen to the way that other people think, find common ground, and then win them over. And social media kind of works against that, right? Because you're not face-to-face with the other person. You don't see them as a human. You can just form a vision of what they're like in your mind, and usually it's bad. And then you mock, you degrade, you demean, you tell partial truths about them and their political party and their worldview. And both sides are doing it. There's not really two sides in American politics, but, you know, everyone's doing it. And we have an opportunity to carve out a better path. Tim Keller, who always puts it the best, says, you know, we've got a truth without grace makes us a bully in the political square. Grace without truth makes us a wimp. Truth and grace together, that combination that Jesus taught us, I think that's what we're aiming for.
Bruce, man, time is flying by. Let me try to land the plane by asking you a question and teeing you up for the last few moments here of commentary. For pastors listening to this podcast, for people who have been entrusted with a public ministry, what would be dangers they should keep in mind, cautions they should keep in mind as it relates to engaging political issues in the life of the local church, especially from the pulpit?
Yeah, so I think pastors should be very, very careful politicking from the pulpit. And here's what I mean. The institutional church, the church when it gathers, has a very specific calling and a very specific set of things it's supposed to do. And those are delineated very clearly in Scripture. And when it comes to preaching, we're supposed to preach the Word of God and apply it in ways that we're very confident of. But the Bible rarely ever speaks directly to policy issues on a 21st century democratic republic in the United States. That's a process of indirect reasoning. Pastors and churches are neither called nor competent to be public policy think tanks. And when we do that, we actually reduce the credibility of our preached message because we equate our public policy pronouncements with sort of the same level of gravitas as our proclamation that Jesus is Lord. And so there are some instances, I think, when we can speak to public policy issues, but we have to be very sure that our words are the words of God. So I think that's a pretty rare instance. Then the second is, I think as a pastor, and just as a Christian, when we're preaching, we've got to remember we have people in our church, members of both parties, possibly, hopefully, and we want to speak to them and give them the dignity and respect they deserve as humans, not to mock and demean their political views or treat them as self-evidently absurd or bad, but to enter in and persuade. And so I think that kind of persuasion happens best when a preacher preaches the word instead of politicking from the pulpit. And then maybe when the pastor engages them one-on-one or in third spaces on political issues. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very well stated. Bruce, it's been a joy to have you in the studio today. Talking about the pastor and politics, to those listening, I would commend Dr. Ashford's resources, including his personal blog. And he has a number of books out, some of which speak to this very issue, these very topics. Bruce, thank you for joining me on Preaching and Preachers.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, please visit my website, jasonkallen.com.